So, Mr. Hsu, just wanted to say thanks again for meeting with us today and taking the time to be here. My name is Dixie Noonan, as I said, and this is my colleague Kim Schaefer, and we work for the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I'm sure you know that. And the commission has been tasked with examining the causes of the financial crisis that the United States, the world economy experienced in 2008. And as part of that, we are looking into the role of complex financial derivatives and the role that they played in the financial crisis. So one of the things that piqued our interest was reading about the work that you did at Deutsche Bank with Greg Lippman on shorting. I believe that the title of the flip book is Shorting Home Equity Mezzanine Tranches. Is that right? I should probably just look at it. Right. So we'll go. I mean, I've seen several versions of this, and would like to go through a little bit of it with you just to sort of get an understanding. But first, I wondered if we could just start more generally, if you could give us an overview of your educational and professional background.
Sure. My name is Eugene Hsu. I have a PhD degree from UCLA for mathematics. I got my degree in 1992, and after I got the degree, I worked in Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton until 1993. After that, I became an analyst in a financial firm called Smith Barney, and I worked in the mortgage research area. I worked in Smith Barney until spring of 1996, when I joined Chase Manhattan Bank. Actually, by then it was still called Chemical Bank. I still worked as a mortgage research analyst until 1997. In July 1997, I joined Credit Suisse First Boston as a research analyst in asset-backed securities, covering specifically for mortgage-related assets, such as home equity, securitization, and the manufactured housing securitization. In March 2000, I joined Deutsche Bank, still working as a ABS research analyst until February 2007, while I transferred from the research unit to the ABS trading desk as a trading strategist on the desk until May 2010. I have recently resigned from the Deutsche Bank, and I'm planning to join a hedge fund started by several of my colleagues.
At Deutsche Bank?
At Deutsche Bank.
What's the name of the hedge fund going to be called?
We still tentatively named it as a Libre Max. LIBREMAX.
And are you joining this hedge fund with Greg Lippman?
Yes, with Greg Lippman, Brett Freischneider,
Jordan Millman?
Yeah, and myself.
What was Brett's last name? I'm sorry.
Fred Breschneider.
Oh, Fred. How do you spell his last name?
B-R-E S-C-H M-E-I-D-E-R.
Okay, great, thanks. So you've been in the mortgage research area for quite some time.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about what you did as a mortgage research analyst at Smith Barney and at Chemical Bank? What that involved? Was that on the fixed income side even then? Or?
Yes. I started as a quantitative quantitative analysts, specifically in charging the modeling of interest rate model. And later on, I sort of my duty sort of drifted to the building of prepayment model for the mortgage. You know, at that time, it's mostly agency mortgages. And later on, you know, of course, I also did some other quantitative analysis. When I became the ABS, you know, research analyst in Credit First Boston, my role changed to from the prepayment related work to credit related work. But you know, in a sense, it's you know, it's kind of a continued. You know, there is a continuity about it. It's I still deal with the mortgage products and a lot of issues in that. You know, those two kinds of research are really related.
So, would you have written research reports, or were you involved more in structuring deals?
My main work was really as a publishing research analyst. So I basically spent most time writing the research and, of course, doing quantitative analysis behind those research. And occasionally I also give speech or join panel discussions in the industry gathering. Stuff like that. So basically propagating my view to the world.
So we know from Michael Lewis's book that you worked on some deals in 2006 and 2007 with Greg Lipman on the subprime market. I'm curious to know, given your background in mortgage research, what your own opinion and views were on the mortgage market in the years leading up to 2006. Did you see things changing before you started working with Greg Lipman on these deals?
First, in the early 2000, I mean, maybe before 2005, I was pretty bullish, you know, with the rest of people, the mortgage market, you know, seeing these, even though they are subprime mortgage lending to the, you know, people with, you know, credit which is not perfect, you know. But we've seen, you know, these loans has, you know, performed okay. And it seems to everything worked out just fine. From time to time there are some credit issues, but somewhere around 2005, where people are talking about interest rate was rising, and there are a ongoing argument among market participants, not necessarily within the, you know, subprime mortgage market, but you know, in a more broader market, there are some discussions about, you know, there is a bubble, housing bubble, and once the bubble bursts, that's gonna cause some, you know, chaos or, you know, wreak some havoc, if you will, in the market. And so, of course, as you know, part of our job is to find out what the impact would be, you know, if something did happen. We haven't really envisioned any home price crashing. We haven't envisioned any, you know, like price crash like we just, you know, had the last few years. But we thought that, you know, it's might be, you know, like the home price was had been, you know, double digit growth for, you know, like several years, and that's definitely kind of not the historical norm. So it's like, so it goes beyond the historical norm. So can it be like a, there is a softening, you know, in the in the housing market, we want to find what would you know, what would that cost. And we went back to the historical performance data that's, you know, we acquired from Loan Performance, a third party data provider, and did some analysis. To our surprise,
how far back were you, was the data?
The data for some deals, it went all over back to, I think, early 1990s.
Was this, would this be on mortgages, or would it be on mortgage-backed securities?
Well, it will be securitized subprime mortgages.
Okay.
Yeah. And to our surprise, we found that, you know, if home price slow down, it doesn't need to crash. If it slow down, we are likely to see some dramatic increase in losses.
So did you start looking into this in 2005? Go ahead.
Forgive me, I just want to clarify. You said there was some data from LPC going back even to the 90s. Were you looking there at HPA related to subprime, or you were looking at delinquency?
The loan data, not just HPI.
So the delinquencies? Or just you know, payments and prepayments?
It has delinquency data coming out of some deals. The data was more, you know, sparse for early 90s, but there are like several deals that actually went back to like 1992, if I still remember correctly.
Forgive me, the confusion that I'm just trying to understand is, you had been talking about the home price appreciation stress, and then you were referring to the loan performance data, and I don't have in-depth familiarity with that. So I'm just trying to understand what you were looking at in loan price performance looking historically, and then what other, whether your home price information was coming from there or coming from some other database.
Sure, you know, like I'd like to, you know, thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify my own comments, because there are really two sets of data. One set of data is the mortgage loan level data, which has, you know, delinquencies, you know, losses, et cetera, et cetera. And that, when I say it went back to 1990s, I was referring to that set of data. It comes from Loan Performance. A company called Loan Performance, and we generally call it LP data. And there is another set of data is about the housing market that's published by OFIL, Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight. And so that set of data has by MSA, in the metropolitan statistical area, the home prices. So we basically coupled these two sets of data, because, you know, on the mortgage side, the LP data has a loan, which zip code it is in, etc., etc. And we found the zip code, and we found the zip code that we're trying to find what MSA it's in.
You can link the MSA based on the zip code from the LP data.
Yes, and basically, then we're trying to see, okay, if, you know, if for this MSA, these loans in this MSA, how do they perform? How did they perform? And we were able to segregate those MSA with high HPA, home price appreciation, and from those loans in the MSA that had historically had a low, you know,
So you really were, and this is what I wanted to understand, please correct me if I'm misstating something, that you really were going back and looking at HPA performance in subprime lending areas. It wasn't sort of general broad mortgage market HPA. You were really focused on what was going on where there had been subprime lending.
The HPA data, it doesn't really tell us whether it's for subprime or for it just says this is the, you know, like for example Los Angeles,
right?
And here is Los Angeles from whatever year, you know, home price has increased, you know, year after year, and it gave us the rates for the increase. So yeah.
But I thought you were drawing a, forgive me if I'm still misunderstanding, I thought you were drawing a connection between the two databases so that you actually could test and sort of back, where I thought you were going is that you were back testing essentially on the subprime data the effects of HPA in those zip codes.
That's correct. We basically, what we had is on one hand, you know, on one hand, is the LP data that's sub, you know, about subprime, and on the other hand is the Ophelia data that's about the home price appreciation. It didn't really, the Ophelia data really isn't about subprime or prime, it's just, you know, housing market. So we match those data and say, you know, like for example Los Angeles historically from 2000 it has grown, you know, maybe over 10% a year. Detroit, you know, Michigan, over the same period only grow like 1%. So we were trying to say, you know, now how did the subprime mortgages perform in Los Angeles versus in Detroit?
And so just so to clarify, the LP data would also show what proportion of them were in a particular zip code?
It has the loan by loan. It basically has, you know, a loan, its zip code, and its payment history,
right,
the delinquency history.
Does it also have FICO scores and
it
things like the type of loan?
Yeah, it has the FICO scores at the time it's the loan was originated.
Yes.
So we basically we...
This is all just interesting to us. We're, one of the things that we're trying to do is figure out what information was available to people at the time. And so it's interesting to us from that perspective. So thank you for giving us more detail.
Sure. So we match those two data, and we try to look at the loss history, you know, in terms of the default, the rate of defaults, and the loss severity, which is basically how the percentage of loan really realize a loss once it's defaulted. So we, to our surprise, we found that you really do not need a home price crash to for the loss to, you know, go up dramatically.
So just so I understand, I think that you were talking about there was discussion in the market generally about whether there was a housing price bubble.
Yeah.
And it led you to sort of start looking at these issues. Was there a point when you were looking at it on your own, or was someone asking you to? Was
the initial request came from Greg Lippman.
Had you worked with him before?
Yes,
okay.
We work together very frequently because he is the trader for on the credit side of the mortgage product, and I'm the research analyst who cover the credit side of the mortgage products. So he often asks my opinion on how, you know, the performance would be, how the market looks like, and stuff like that. I will come to him to ask about, you know, how the market pricing action, you know, like all the market, how they, you know, like the market color, so to speak.
And pricing of the bonds.
Pricing of the bond, and sometimes, you know, like the volume of the trade and stuff like that.
The what of the trade?
The volume of
the trade.
Yeah. So in our jargon, market color. So, we talk very frequently, and he came over and says, "What do you think about any impact of a, you know, home price softening on the mortgage performance.
Around when with this event, do you remember?
I think it was in August 2005.
And you said that you were surprised to find that you didn't need a decline in home prices. Is it HPA?
Yeah.
In home prices, just for them to stay flat in order for what?
Yeah, for the losses to pick up dramatically.
For the losses in what?
For example, the analysis, I saw you.
Well, I was going to, why don't we just go ahead and use this? Because I think this is, I think this is what we're talking about. This is, it's a Deutsche Bank document, DB FCIC 00000378. It's a January 2006 version of the shorting home equity mezzanine tranche flipbook.
Yeah.
Is this the right slide? Slide 6
this
and 7?
Is one
there are more copies in the table. Yeah, I know.
The page 6 is one of the slides. I think there should be another. Page 8 is another slide. So if you look at the slide, you would see that for mortgage loans originated between 2000 and 2005. We basically put MSAs in four quartiles based on their average home price appreciation rate.
So, for example, Los Angeles would be in a high quartile, and something like Detroit would be in a low quartile.
Correct.
Okay.
And you can see the lines on page 8, are the cumulative defaults of mortgage loans and subprime mortgage loans.
How do you define subprime here? Just so I'm clear.
That's a good question. We just a loan is called a subprime. Often. It's because it's in a subprime deal. So it's kind of a circular, but I know. But because when a issuer, a mortgage deal issuer, issue a deal, it usually says this deal is subprime because the FICO score is below certain level. But definition is only in principle, because you do find loans in a subprime deal can have a FICO score of 800, which is definitely a high score. So, but we call it a subprime loan anyway because it's in a subprime deal. The reason that it's in a subprime deal because there is something else wrong with the loan.
For example, it's a no-doc loan.
It could be a no-doc loan. It could be the guy had a 800 FICO score just because he had no history or something like that. And the lender, he might not be able to qualify for a, prime loan for whatever reason. And so he fell through the cracks, so to speak, and he, his loan end up in a subprime deal.
So it has a higher interest rate.
It has a higher interest rate. Yeah, usually there is some reason, behind that. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
It's helpful, and it's a constant refrain that we've come across as we've done our investigations, is that there is no standard definition of subprime, which is an interesting point that you raise. I'm sort of curious, if you were using something like the loan performance data for this, just wonder if you would have carved out FICO scores, or if you would have pulled this data based on mortgages that were in quote-unquote subprime deals.
Well, we don't, in this analysis, the specific analysis on this page, we did not control the FICO score. because the FICO score, we feel like, yes, you can have, you know, certain loans that have a higher FICO score, but if there's no evidence that it's actually concentrated in Los Angeles or it's concentrated in the high, you know, HPA area rather than the low HPA area. Actually, later on, we found that actually it's more the reverse. You have a tiny slight more high FICO score loan that's actually coming out of those low HPA area. And, you know, whatever the reason that is. But, you know, my point, I guess, is we didn't control the FICO score for this particular analysis, but later on, we actually made some effort to control the FICO score. And it basically doesn't change the consequence of the, you know, the result of the analysis.
So the analysis as of January 06 wouldn't have controlled for FICO score. Where would you have been pulling? I understand the quartile data would have been based on the MSA data from OFEO, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And I'm just wondering where the loan data came from and the losses.
Those are from loan performance.
They are from loan performance.
Yeah.
So you pulled a sample of something that was labeled subprime, but you didn't necessarily control for the FICO score.
We didn't control the FICO score.
Is LP data, is it only subprime data?
No, they actually provide more than just subprime. They also supply data for so-called Alt A, as well as a private label prime view.
Would this have included Alt A, for example?
This doesn't include Alt A. You know, the one thing about the loan performance data, it show you a loan and which deal it's in, which pool it's in, and the deal that for each of the pool, they actually label it subprime pool or Alt A pool or prime pool. We just use the subprime pool.
Okay. Yeah. Where do they put home equity loans?
We use home equity and subprime exchangeability.
Okay, so one of the reasons I asked that is because of the title of the slide deck,
yeah,
which is shorting home equity mezzanine tranches.
Yeah.
So would this be limited to home equity, or this is all subprime?
Well, it's used exchangeably. So basically, there's the market jargon at that time was that home equity deals are just subprime mortgage deals. And later on, you know, like when people get more specific on I only want a second lien deal, or, you know, then home equity deal may be just the second lien deal.
Or a purchase money mortgage for someone with a lower FICO score or with an alternative mortgage product.
This is a subprime. You know, I mean, you know.
But it's not included in here. This is all home equity.
No, this is a subprime.
Okay, this includes more than home equity.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so the result on page 8, you can see that the first quartile, meaning those areas with average HPA around 12.7%, and it's really from, you know, 10.959 to 18.92%. After 5 years from origination, the cumulative defaults was something around 7%. Okay, that's defaults, not the loss. And for the worst quartile, which is the HPA is between, the annual HPA is between like a negative 0.53 to 4.47%. The average was 3.67%. It went to the losses went to very close to like 25%. And if you look at the slope of the curve, you can expect that it will go even higher from that point.
Excuse me, I believe you said losses.
Defaults.
You mean defaults.
I mean defaults. I'm sorry. So that's what the page 8, the chart on the page 8 tells us.
So in other words, if you're in a metropolitan metropolitan statistical area that doesn't have very significant home price appreciation, then you're going to see more significant losses in the subprime area than you would with areas that have a lot of home price appreciation.
Yeah.
And so, presumably, I mean, does this slide alone tell you, or did you take this and then do another analysis that would show if the home price appreciation in this highest quartile were to flatten out or drop, then these losses would shoot up dramatically?
Yeah, it will be more resemble more of the last quartile than in terms of the defaults.
And this chart alone tells you that?
This chart alone,
are there more charts that sort of show that too? Or?
Well, at that time, there is no, because Los Angeles, for example, had always had a fantastic, home price appreciation. We don't have any historical data that shows us, like, if an area had, very high HPA, and suddenly it's dropped, how the losses is going to be. So we didn't have that data. But we use this to infer that the HPA was a very large driving force behind losses, behind the defaults. And now, if you look at page 6, this is on the loss severity side. So as you see that here, we did not do it by quartile, but by actually by individual MSA. Each dot on that chart represent an MSA. So, and the x-axis is the average annual HPA in the last 5 years, between 2000 and 2005. And the y-axis is the loss severity. Basically, it's a percentage of losses that you're going to get out of a default. And as you can see that if you are in, over 10% HPA area, then most of those MSA only has very low, I think it's below 30%, certainly below 30%, and maybe, the dotted line is like a trend line, and you can see that it's basically very low. In the area that where it only has like 2%, the loss severity is above like 50%, something like that. And so you can not only that the defaults will be dramatically higher, but your loss severity will be dramatically higher as well. And
you're showing the losses assuming a delinquency?
Assuming a default.
Assuming a default.
Yeah.
So this is not, the other chart was predicting, was showing the breakdown of, now I'm forgetting whether it's delinquency or default.
The defaults, also.
A
cumulative
defaults,
yeah.
But here it's really already the subset. This is like the entire
universe.
loan universe.
Yeah.
This page 6 is only the universe where you have already had a default.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So in other words, like I said, page 8 tell me that the last quartile, MSA in the last quartile is like more than 3 times likely for a loan to get default. Page 8 tell me that once the loan gets default, you are going to realize almost like 5 times as high losses. So the compounding is like 15 times. You can assume that losses will be 15 times as high. And what we, this struck us as, very dramatic. When we started doing the analysis, we didn't anticipate that. I did anticipate some, sensitivity, but not that dramatic. So So that's, you know, how, you know, we that's start to change our view. And after that, we went back to, you know, look at the practice of the certain lenders. And we found that, okay, you know, not only that, this is history, right? You know, like the recent loans, you know, when we did the analysis, these are loans like originated in 2000 through 2005. But if you look at the loans that originated in 2005, the quality of the loan is actually worse than the loan that's, you know, originated in 2000. Just because the LTV is dramatically higher, lenders are, you know, offering like silent seconds. And also there are more loans that's so-called a stated income loan, which, you know, some people call them liar loan. And
where did you go to get this information?
It's actually in the loan performance data as well. They gave you, you know, like what LTV, you know, what, you know, how much the house was appraised at, and all stuff like that. Then there were those anecdotal stories about, you know, how brokers like, you know, like fill the income, you know, fields for the borrowers, and all those like stories about it, and that sort of just kind of reinforced our impression that, you know, the recent loans are, you know, maybe perform even worse than the analysis will show us.
As a counterpoint to this, if you can, just broad brush ballpark. We're talking about sort of late 05, sort of second half of 05. What was ballpark the assumption in the marketplace as to what losses, what the range of defaults would be, and the range of loss severity expectations would be related to subprime? Obviously, it varies by originator, it varies by a lot of things, but yeah. Can you cuff that in some general way for us?
Yeah, sure. If you look at how these deals were structured, and the rating agencies are probably expecting somewhere around the 4 to 5% of losses, and when you the rating agency, of course, you know, they got historical data behind these analysis, and they, you know, historical data really came in like for ARM loans, for example, adjustable rate loans, the losses are like running like at 2% or things like that. And really, you can say rating agency was, you know, already, you know, conservative about this. So so the market really expected, you know, pretty low losses. And
you're saying there was an argument that could be made that the rating agencies were conservative because they were projecting 4 to 5% losses when the historical losses on adjustable rate
was running 2.
Sorry, what you were doing in your presentation was unpacking defaults and then loss severity, which when multiplied together end up with losses. So I was actually specifically asking the question, what was the loss severity? Was there a loss severity thought, and was there a default thought that when multiplied together ended up in this, because there are different combinations that could end up in the 4 to 5% loss.
Sure. Well, if you look at the rating agency's criteria around that time, and the rating agency were generally assume a loss severity about 35%, and
And therefore, you were saying it should be double that, at least when corrected for HPA.
Yeah, that's
what I was trying to get at. Okay.
Were their assumptions different for subprime versus prime?
For prime, I think at that time, I think they used the same loss severity for prime and subprime. The argument was, once the loan defaults, it doesn't really matter whether it's subprime or subprime. But, you know, in reality, it probably matter. But, you know, like, if you really look at the rating agency criteria, they, you know, not so much as to differentiate, you know, as long as, you know, talking about the loss severity. So they're around 35%. And they, for the subprime deals, they generally, you know, arrived at 4 to 5% area. So you 4 to 5% divided by 35%, you probably get something, you know, like more like 12, 15% for the default rate.
14.28.
Yeah. So, and at that time, the real losses were running around 2%. So, you know, like, if you someone would criticize the rating agency about this, you know, like, if you don't really do this analysis, you can't. It's kind of hard to criticize them as being like overly lenient. And but our view is, this is gonna. You cannot rely too much on the historical performance. You really, you know, have to get into a deeper level about the analysis.
And again, so instead of 14 or 15% defaults, you were saying when you correct for HPA, you're more in the neighborhood of 25%.
Yeah.
And that's historical, and that's not yet factoring into the deterioration in quality.
Yes.
But that's if home price appreciation
if the home price moderate.
Yes, I was saying with correcting for home price appreciation, what I meant by saying that is that it moderates or goes flat, or at least doesn't have these substantial increases.
Yeah.
And did, other than this presentation, which is now famous, did you write this up in one of your research reports?
Correct.
That DB
correct
normally publishes and distributes?
Yeah, I think the very next pieces in the research paper, you know, in the research publication I wrote, was this, you know, similar charts was on that piece. I think it was published in early September 2005. So we basically saying we anticipate a, you know, the recent market was crazy, you know, in terms of the spread gets too tight. No, the risk of a home price driven, you know, losses are not priced in, were not priced in. We anticipated a correction in the price. So that was September 2005.
So I saw a report that Lori Goodman and team published, but I think that was probably a year later.
Yeah, you were
quite early.
Yes, I believe we were among the earliest at least in terms of a published opinion. I don't know other people hold the same opinion but didn't publish. But in terms of a publication, I'm pretty comfortable to say that I'm the first. So, and later on, not only that we published that, but in almost every industry gathering, when I sat on a panel of discussion, you know, with other research analysts, I probably will be, you know, like an outlier in terms of opinion. So,
Chris, can we get Mr. Hsu's research reports from 06 to 08?
Yeah.
From 06 to 08, you just run
I mean, 05. September 05, and then he switches to the desk in February 07.
Oh, so just through then.
Just through
then. I meant 05. So I just want to, I have a couple of questions. The loss severity that you would project then for sort of these first quartile, assuming home price declines or home price staying flat, it assumes that the loss severity would be the same. in a Los Angeles as it would in Detroit. Is that right?
Well, we did, you know, like caviar it. There are some mitigating factor, you know, like, you know, California's state law require only on average 4 months of foreclosure time, where, you know, like Michigan law would have much longer. You know, there are some, you know, factor, but, you know, still our point was, you know, if adjusting for all that factor, you're still going to have a quite dramatic increase in loss severity.
What assumptions did you, well, trying to figure out the way to ask this, were you making assumptions that house prices would decline, or did you, what was the basis for that assumption?
In the beginning, our point was the risk was not properly priced in the market. You know, I was kind of agnostic in terms of whether the home price is going to drop or, you know, the home price is going to rise again, you know, continue to rise, because, you know, nobody has a crystal ball on that. But, you know, we sense that there is more probability for the home price to moderate, then it will continue to grow like double digit. And the market seems like does not, you know, just shrug it off and say it will be okay, even if the home price, you know, like drop. You know, my point was, you know, you should at least price that risk in, and the spread should be wider, you know.
So if you price it in, just so I understand, I apologize, yeah. I don't have as much of a quantitative background. I mean, where would that price come in? Would it come in interest rates? Are you talking about the bonds?
The spread was, yeah, the bonds.
You're talking about the bonds. You're talking about pricing and risk in the price of the bonds.
Yeah. And at that time, the triple B spread was running around, I believe, around 100 basis points. And so if you...
So the spread between triple B and triple A.
No, but between the triple B, if you look at the yield of the triple B bond and compare it to the swap rate, or LIBOR rate, there is only, the difference was only 100 basis point. And we thought this is just too little.
I'm sorry, 100 basis points between what and what?
Between the yield in the subprime, triple B subprime,
yes,
mortgage bond,
yes,
and the swap rate.
The interest rate swap?
Yeah, no. The interest rate swap.
LIBOR.
The difference between the bond yield and LIBOR.
That's
you the spread. Point difference. Yeah. The spread.
Above LIBOR.
Yeah.
What am I missing from this chart?
What page are you on?
Back on 4.
It was... Okay, here, the triple B... Yeah, if you look at... Okay, around that time, I think, was... Yeah, it's 150 on the chart, but the sun bonds really was trading around 100.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then it looks like you published your piece in, did you say, in September of 2005? And
yeah.
Then spreads widened out considerably soon thereafter in triple Bs?
Yeah. Well, that's dumb luck, I guess. Spread did widen up towards the end of the year, but to our chagrin, it's actually tightened back
in. And then it came back in.
Yeah.
As your chart shows.
Yeah.
But do you were there certain events that you recall that triggered this spike up and then tightening back in?
I think towards the end of 2005. Oh, 05, I'm sorry. There are some mortgage, traditional mortgage buyers pulled back a little bit. Basically, I wouldn't say that they heeded my call, but, you know, like they view that suddenly, you know, like there are a lot of factors, but I think, you know, the aggregate result was a lot of traditional buyers actually pulled back, causing the spread to widen. And but after the new year, the new money actually came in, and it drives the spread, you know, tighter.
And were those buyers different from the buyers in 05?
There are more CDO manager activity. There were, yeah, you know, like we will see more buyers, you know, from Europe, from Asia. They just came in and are looking for the exposure in the mortgage market, in the subprime mortgage market.
This is a little bit dramatic. Do you think that's am I overstating things to say that this spike is dramatic? Because it certainly would support the hypothesis that has been out in the marketplace that you seem to be indicating was true in your experience, that the traditional buyers of triple B subprime mortgages got concerned, started pulling back, exiting, spreads widened out as a result, and then the CDO bid replaced them in a fairly short time frame, actually, and spreads ratcheted back.
There are, I wouldn't say, you know, before that time frame, there was certainly CDO activity as well, but it was towards, you know, fourth quarter. I don't know for, you know, what the exact reason, but there were some people, you know, even the CDO shops start to pull back a little bit in the fourth quarter of 05, and then I honestly do not know the exact, you know, can't pin down the exact reason, but it appears there was a little pullback in the activity towards the end of the year.
It'd be interesting to sort of overlay this with a chart showing the CDO activity in the mezz tranches, I guess.
Can you time also on this continuum when the standardization of pay-as-you-go swaps started and the synthetic ABS CDO?
The standardized pay-as-you-go ABS CDS happened somewhere around middle of 2005, if I remember correctly. I cannot be too sure about that. I'm pretty sure that in the beginning of 06, ABX, the first ABX in series was issued in 2006. And by then, the you know, standardized ABS CDS was already...
I had to exist.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
That's right.
What was first done in February of 06?
The ABX index.
Oh, the ABX index.
Yeah.
I had a question about something on page 9. Sort of the last bullet on the page says, if home price appreciation rates slow down to 4%, I'm assuming per annum, mm-hmm. for MSAs currently having double-digit rates, losses, both defaults and severity ratios, may increase substantially in these MSAs. I've heard a little bit of the background for that, but I'm wondering what the specific background for the 4% is, and if there was a model or a chart that I've missed or that's not in this slide deck that sort of modeled this assumption.
Were you talking about why there is a 4% there? I guess, you know, at that time, people say soft landing, they're talking about, you know, like 4%.
So you picked 4% as your starting assumption.
Yeah.
And then said what would happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is there anything more specific around what would happen other than just sort of the color of that the losses may increase substantially?
Well, this was, you know, like, I guess, you know, this comes to this was the pitch book,
mm-hmm.
right? So pitch book would, you know, we generally go to a investor who, well, we want them to short the mezzanine tranche. So, but we do not want to oversell our point. Our point is really, you know, we do not need a home price to crash, right? And so, you know, like pick a number that, you know, you think it's reasonable. Well, 4%, is that reasonable? You know, most people at that time would say yes. So that's why we put 4% there.
So in your own models, though, what would the losses have looked like at 4%?
Well, we anticipate the losses will go to somewhere around, like, you know, like above 7%. You know,
which would
like
have wiped out triple B tranches.
Well, it would start to, you know, like start to eat into many of those triple B minus tranche. And the triple B minus tranche was priced at, you know, 250 around that time. And
250 basis points.
Above LIBOR.
Oh.
Above LIBOR. So, and, you know, our point is this is not sustainable. You know, once, you know, if we have people, more people to see this kind of losses, you know, people would certainly require a higher spread for that. And if you short that tranche, you probably will, you know, gain by then. So that was our point.
Did you go on the pitches?
Yeah.
Did the pitches start in January of 2006?
I think.
Do you remember?
I don't remember exactly what the date it started, but it's...
I will tell you this is the first dated one I saw in the production.
Yeah, I think, you know, at that time it must be, you know, there was already a pitch meeting. It was like in the winter of, you know, 05, 06, so that's, you know, that probably around that time.
What were the first reactions that people had?
Very few people actually believed us. Actually,
do you remember some of the early investors you met with, potential investors?
Yes, mostly the hedge funds, such as, you know, John Paulson was one, Omega, Harbinger, Marathon.
What did Paulson say?
Well, he was actually pretty bearish on the housing market already, and he was looking for some product to express his view, and so it didn't, you know, he was an easy sell. So, but some of those other guys are very reluctant to accept. You know, a lot of even very, very sophisticated investors, they would agree with my analysis, you know, everything you did was correct, but U.S. government won't allow this to happen.
How could the U.S. government stop it from happening?
Well, they will intervene and you know, like the things like, you know, this, you know, we would end up losing money doing insurance.
Based on the type of product that you were selling, the credit default swap, like a regulatory intervention, or was it more of something directly into the housing market was what they were?
Anything. I guess people talked about the U.S. government may just give homeowner, you know, every homeowner, like, you know, $100,000, you know, like that was what people talked about. And, you know, so they are just saying, you know, there are a lot of other risks doing this kind of trade. So...
This is similar to the types of intervention that actually were discussed when housing prices started to fall in terms of protecting borrowers from losing their houses.
Yeah, that's that kind of thing. So
even as early as sort of winter 05, early 06, people were thinking in those terms.
Yeah.
Would you please explain your role in the context of the broader Deutsche Bank mortgage efforts? I would think that you might have made yourself unpopular with some groups of your colleagues
yes.
with this analysis, and I'd just like to understand that picture better.
Well, that I imagine this is a question, you know, like there are several several layers of answers to that. You know, like first, my role, I was a research analyst, and people somehow view me as a straight talker, and they'd like, you know, you're like, you know, if someone wants to hear, you know, like what I was going to say, they would, you know, like sometimes investors says, you know, what your research analysts think, you know, like Eugene Hsu, and I would maybe, you know, they will set up meeting, you know, with investor, and I just talk about what I'm thinking about the market, and yes, the
and these could be people who were long or short or thinking
long or short, you know, like ever since we published this kind of reports, you know, like I guess the view was, you know, at least for people who invested in this sector, most people already know what my view was like. So some people who are very long, you know, and religiously long, did not want to hear what I'm saying, gonna say, because they think I was crazy. Greg, for example, wants me to meet all these potential, CDS investors, so that I can talk about the case as the research analyst. Yes, inside the bank, probably people do not, you know, some people did not like what I had to say. And
what about, for example, the Deutsche Bank CDO desk people who were actually putting CDOs together and selling long positions in?
They probably would think I was, you know, I was too bearish for them.
Did you work with them at all?
I work with them in terms of, you know, exchange ideas, and they still ask me, you know, what I think. They may not agree with me, but, you know, they still, sometimes I'll get some, you know, color from them about how the market was going, and they would ask my opinion. You know, sometimes they want my opinion anyway, so so there are degree, there is a spectrum of opinions on the how the market will end up to be, even within the research. My boss at that time was Karen Weaver, who held a much somehow rosier opinion on the performance than I did. But, you know, to her credit, he never intervened what I was going to, you know, write about. And there was no like official pressure on me to change my view or stuff like that. So I had a quite free hand to express my view. So even though DB at that time, we also issue ABS, you know, like still, like, you know, like nobody actually officially came to me like, you cannot do this, you know, like so I guess we gained some credibility on that too.
Were there other research analysts that at Deutsche Bank that disagreed with you and published research in disagreement?
Well, I was thought the, you know, like an authority in the mortgage, you know, credit area. So, like, you know, they probably hold, you know, like, you know, there is the subprime mortgage piece was written by me, and that thought, you know, is, you know, but they might have a, you know, rosier view than I do. They, you know, when they go on with the client, they probably, you know, like express their view more, which are somehow, you know, different from mine. That's.
Do you recall when your competitors, other analysts at other major firms, started publishing anything about lower underwriting standards or the effect of HPA as you did?
In the beginning, I was kind of lonely, and so I had arguments with my competitors in the discussion panel. They basically, when I said, recently we found, anecdotal evidence that, some people may not, be qualified, but got a mortgage anyway, and that kind of thing. And, the data really shows that the actual LTV for the borrowers are actually much higher in recent year than it was several years ago. And that caused us to basically be concerned about if there is, yes, we are okay now because we had this fantastic home price appreciation. Once it's moderated, then we would run into all sorts of trouble. And one of my, fellow analysts on the discussion panel would say, never actually underestimate the American, ingenuity of the American lenders, that they would design the products that was, basically solve the problem. So to me, that is, he's a much better talker than I was. He sort of put this very convincingly, yet I think it's kind of BS because it's dangerous for me. You are kind of getting sort of religious to think that, yes, we will solve that problem anyway. To me, it's dangerous. But later on, I guess, towards the end of 06, or, there are more people starting to write about issues.
Well, for example, I think there were a couple of articles in Grant's Interest Rate Observer. Are you familiar with those? I think it was October and November of 2006, making a similar point almost a year later, it sounds like, or at least over a year later, about how home prices didn't have to decline. They just had to stay flat for some of these tranches to get wiped out.
Yes.
Please, just focusing again on your competitors and street research, I'd like to understand a little bit better the picture of when others, and if you recall any, notable pieces or notable shifts in views of your competitors where you stopped being so lonely.
Well, you mentioned Lori Goodman later on. She did publish some of those things. Chris Flanagan, who sort of converted to a more bearish view towards.
Where was he?
JP Morgan. These are, probably two of the better known people.
And do you recall roughly when?
I cannot really recall the exact time, but.
Okay, thank you.
If we could look at the June 2007 slide deck now. Do you have this?
Yeah.
Okay. I think there are a couple of extra charts. At least I didn't see this one, page 32. I didn't see this one in sort of the January 2006. I wondered if you might. It's actually the top slide that I was.
Oh, this one? Yeah.
if you could sort of walk me through this analysis, what this slide shows, and when you developed this analysis.
Yeah. But basically, this is to it's a representation of a very boiled down default model. You know, meaning Greg Lipman and myself went on to those pitching meetings, people would think, give us an idea how your model would predict the losses can go. So we basically put together a simple chart here. Basically, we fixed FICO score as, you know, 630. CLTV, which is combined LTV, be 85. And full doc, the 6% of the pool would be full doc.
60%.
And unemployment rate would be 5%. And the balance of the loan, average balance of the loan would be 200,000. In this pool, so what kind of losses our model would expect? Basically, here you can see, you know, the x-axis is the home price appreciation average rate. So
what does CAGR stand for?
I think is compounding average growth rate. Those, we borrow this from the equity area. Because we talk to a lot of people who are traditional equity investors. So you can see that one line is lifetime default rate and the loss severity ratio rate and lifetime net loss rate. That is just, you know, a multiplication of the two previous lines. Yeah, so the default rate and the loss rate are pertaining to the left y-axis.
That's I see.
Yeah, so that's the percentage of original pool balance, and the loss severity ratio will pertain to the right axis. And
so, for example, at a growth rate of 4%, this would be home price appreciation.
Yeah.
Is this basically home price appreciation?
Yes.
For 5 years,
yes, for
average.
5 years, yes.
At 4%, the default rate would be somewhere between 15 and 20%.
Yeah.
Or closer to 20%.
Yeah.
And then the net loss rate would be 7.7%.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is sort of memorializing what we discussed a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
About the impact of your analysis.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. I had one.
Interesting. So you really haven't reached a substantially different conclusion here than you had from your earlier research this is very rough again, but roughly speaking, if house prices were flat, you're going to have you're going to have subprime losses, kind of 11-12%.
Yes, yes.
And that's what you were saying sort of 6 months earlier.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, yes.
I also had a quick question on slide 37.
Yes.
Mostly because I didn't understand it. What is MH?
That stands for manufactured housing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So were you trying to draw a comparison here?
Yes, because a lot of people we met says that what if, you know, like we continue to have these people continue to be refinanced. As if you are purchasing a CDS, which is basically protection on the bond, if the bond gets prepaid, then there's no loss, right? And if you buy insurance on something that won't have anything lost, the insurance doesn't worth too much. So so the one question is, what if there is continue to have, you know, refinance, you know, people gets refinanced. So we said, you know, if we look at MH history, then you can have a very, you know, heated market. After a problem surfaced, it can quickly dwindle down. And that's, you know, we use MH to as an example.
I see.
Yeah.
Is that the, did you ever hear the phrase, a rolling stone gathers no loss? Is that what that phrase comes from?
Rolling stone gathering no moss?
No, loss. The book says moss.
Yeah.
But I believe it may be loss.
Okay.
Had you ever heard that?
No.
Oh,
okay. yeah, but, you know, that would be a very accurate way to describe, you know, people's concern.
Okay. So I guess I'm still curious a little bit more about the process that you went through with Mr. Lippman to get here. So as I understand it, and just correct me if I'm wrong, he came to you with this idea and said, will you look into this for me?
Yeah.
Do you know where his idea came from?
He has been constantly talking with other people. You know, he's, he must have heard both sides of the argument about, you know, housing price, you know, home price crash. And as a trader, I think he is very sensitive to the consequence. He wants to know, how does that affect my market, you know. And that's why, you know, whether he already had a bearish view on the market, he didn't tell me. So he basically, you know, came, hey, here is an issue. Tell me, what's your opinion? So I didn't have a very strong opinion before that as well. And I said, you know, just let me go to do some analysis and I'll come back. So I came back with this, you know, like somehow astonishing result. And he saw that. He was fully convinced that there will be a crisis. And you know, I become, you know, I certainly think, you know, this is problematic, you know.
How long did it take you to do the analysis?
Not very long. It's probably take a day.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, like...
And you were surprised with the results.
Yeah. I was surprised, you know, like, the results. And also, you know, first I thought, is there something wrong that I did? You know, like, you know, I got some recheck and I can't find anything wrong. And then... it was a pretty simple analysis to begin with. So I was a little bit surprised that nobody else actually had, you know, had done it. So maybe somebody already did it and never told the world.
Well, I am sort of curious. I'm part of my curiosity is about sort of the transparency of the data. And I guess if other people had sort of been curiously minded, would the data have been there for a bunch of other people to have run the same analysis?
Yes, that's why. You know, like the data is, you know, like it's loan performance is just, you know, paid subscription. But most Wall Street firms should have that. And most investors should have that too. So it's not like, you know, we have a secret sauce that, you know, that's why it kind of surprised me as well, why, you know, why nobody actually said anything about it.
Did you have any conversations with people at the rating agencies? Essentially what you're saying is there are some people.
Well, I did, you know, as I said, you know, the panel discussions, sometimes there were rating agency analysts there. And we, because of course, they, you know, would find a lot of arguments supporting, you know, like their view in the market, and I would say something. But the thing about this is nobody really can know for sure. It's not like,
you know, physics law, right? You know, like there is a you can always poke some holes for anybody's model because, oh, you didn't consider that. Oh, actually, you put too much weight on certain factor that it should be, you know, like, oh, this is, you know, like, there are a lot of things that you can say about the statistical model. There's never something like as clear as like gravity. So, you know, so we don't convince each other, basically. We didn't convince each other. So, and I cannot, you know, say, you know, you are so wrong. I would say, you know, well, we have a different view on this.
We can do this later if you have something connected,
okay.
But I'd like to understand better how your job changed when, if it did at all, when you joined the trading desk.
Well, I'm sort of, it was a question I had as well, and just wondering what prompted the change.
Well, the change was Greg Lipman thinking that I spent too much time, you know, doing something else not related to his, you know, desk, because, you know, he said how much you spend, you know, how much time you spend writing articles and, you know, like giving speeches to the public and stuff like that. You know, I said, here is my percentage of time that I spend. He said, I want 100% of your time. And, you know, you think you can do, you want to do it? You know, I said, I'm not necessarily, you know, like to write, you know, my English is not necessarily the best. And so, you know, like, so, and I'm a slow writer, right? You know, like, I constantly, you know, like, change my wording and still, like, say I hate it. So I basically saying, you know, I'm no problem. You know, like, if it's still doing this, you know, analysis that I like to do, I don't have a problem not to speak to, you know, like speak to other investors or whatever. So, you know, I can spend 100% time for you. So, and he said, well, you won't, I think he said, I think you will like it. So I just did the transfer. He actually fought with Karen Weaver. So on that issue. And, but anyway, so, you know, like I moved over to his desk.
So then how did your job responsibilities on sort of a daily basis change?
Well, I no longer require to put the publication, you know, I'm not on the deadline. Yeah, on deadline, you know, like I can basically I'll be doing the thing that I think most interesting, but still, you know, it's heavily, you know, like there is a heavy quantitative portion of it, you know, as before, and I will probably be, you know, focused more on, you know, on day-to-day trading desk issues than the research issue, so. But I still, you know, sometimes some clients still want my opinion and still call me and, you know, like ask for it, and I would continue to give it to them. So.
Take a 2-3 minute break.
Sure. That's good.